From the Voice of America in Washington, this is VOA Global. Hi, glad to have you with us. I'm Jim Stevenson. On today's program, Australian officials are alarmed that young women may be lured to support terrorist groups in Syria as young brides. We hear more on Daybreak Asia. Ray Kugel raises the cinematic curtain for our Friday Cine Asia stop at the movies. Some on Twitter have called it the biggest meeting since Nixon and Mao. Well, maybe not, but Sarah Williams tells us the story of a young American, a lost iPhone, and a Chinese connection in today's China Focus. Sharks are one of the most fearful predators on the planet, but they have their problems too. We hear more with Ira Melman in the American Cafe. David Byrd goes high-tech on today's Now to Train and Track Pets. We'll hear the top five most popular songs of the week, business and sports as well. It's all coming up on today's VOA Global. This is Daybreak Asia. Welcome to our summary of Asian news and events for Friday, February 27th. I'm Jim Stevenson. Among today's headlines, Australian officials are increasingly concerned about young women supporting radical Islamic groups. Ministers warn that some citizens have traveled to Syria and Iraq to become so-called jihadi brides. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Canberra believes there are between 30 and 40 Australian women who've taken part in terror attacks or are supporting the Islamic State terror network. While some are providing active backing at home, others have travelled to the Middle East. Australian Foreign Minister Julie Bishop has told Parliament that an increasing number of Australian women were heading to Iraq or Syria to join husbands fighting with Islamic State or to marry a militant. She's warned potential Islamic State recruits, however, that the group's attitudes towards women were utterly appalling, and said if they travelled to the Middle East, it will be no romantic adventure. She warned that foreign women had ended up as sex slaves, and in some cases, suicide bombers. Homegrown extremism has become a growing concern for Australia's security agencies, and officials fear what might happen if radicalised women return home. About 90 young Australian men are thought to be fighting with Islamic State in Syria and Iraq. Bishop told MPs that females accounted for nearly 20% of all foreign jihadis in Syria and Iraq, and said the number of Australians joining their ranks was a worrying sign.
There is this phenomena of jihadi bride, and this means that young women are either attracted to a male foreign terrorist fighter, they are going with their male partner to Syria and Iraq, or in some instances they're actually looking for a partner and are being told online that there are opportunities for them in Syria and Iraq.
Last September, Canberra raised its domestic terror threat level from medium to high. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
The United States says it is very concerned about a new report that predicts North Korea will expand its nuclear stockpile to as many as 100 weapons by the year 2020. Analysts say there may be disagreements over Pyongyang's nuclear capabilities, but there is no doubt the weapons program poses a growing international threat. We hear more now from VOA's Brian Padden in Seoul.
Experts on nuclear weapons technology at Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies estimate that North Korea currently has 10 to 16 nuclear weapons and is continuing to work on its nuclear program. South Korea Defense Ministry spokesman Kim Min-seok disputed the group's claims about North Korea's current capability. He says the analysis that North Korea has 10 to 16 nuclear weapons is just an assumption by some private groups and experts, and there is no evidence to support this. Bruce Bennett, a defense analyst at the RAND Corporation, is also skeptical the country can produce 100 weapons. He says building that many would require bringing online a new nuclear reactor and pursuing a vigorous uranium enrichment program. He thinks the number will likely be around 50.
If they have 50 nuclear weapons, they can probably kill about 10 to 20 million people with those weapons. That's a huge difference, and it gives them significantly more coercive power against South Korea, against Japan, and against the United States.
Shin-In Kyun, an analyst with the Korea Defense Network, supports preventive military action by the U.S. and its allies to take out North Korean missile sites before they develop offensive nuclear capabilities. He says now is the time to airstrike them, as North Korea cannot attack the United States with nuclear weapons. But other analysts caution against the military option, arguing that it could set off a broader conflict. Brian Patton, VOA News, Seoul.
A Lao Dam project on a section of the Mekong River is drawing opposition from local fishermen, international environmental groups, and neighboring countries. VOA Seimony visited the region to investigate the concerns. Colin Lovett narrates.
Sun Thaya has depended on his taxi boat for his family income for years. On average, he can earn around 200,000 kips, or about $25 a month, bringing tourists to see river dolphins here on the border between Laos and Cambodia. When there are no tourists, the Lao boatman fishes in the area to feed his family. But now, the father of four says his livelihood could be at stake because the Lao government has plans to build a hydropower dam on the Don Sahong Channel, the main channel of the Mekong River, about 2 kilometers upstream from here. The government says the dam is needed for the country's economic development because it could sell the electricity it would generate to neighboring countries such as Thailand. But the 260-megawatt project has drawn concern not just from Lao fishermen like Sun Thaya, but also from officials, civil society groups, and communities all along the Mekong, from Thailand upstream to Cambodia and Vietnam downstream. In Chiang Mai, Porapong Pomon is director of the Living River Siam Association, which works with local communities.
Yeah, in Thailand, we have eight provinces that are located along the Mekong River. And local people, they have been living and depend on the river for many generations, especially for the fishery, riverbank garden, for transportation.
The Dong Sahong Dam is set to block the most important channel of the Mekong River. Independent experts say fish migrate through that channel all year round. At a December consultation conference in Pax Laos, the Vietnam River Network representative, Dung Thien, appealed for the cancellation of the dam project.
We therefore call for the Laos government to immediately cancel the Dong Sahong Dam and for the Cambodian, Thai and Vietnamese governments to take necessary actions to uphold their own responsibilities.
The project's developer, Mega First of Malaysia, says people should not be so concerned because the dam will have no significant impact on nations sharing the Mekong.
The increased dry season flow will facilitate.
Peter Hawkins is the company's environment manager.
Those concerns are not warranted, they're not real. And the reason is that this project, in the scale of the hydropower development in this basin, Mekong Basin, this project is tiny.
But people like Sun Thaya, the Lao fisherman and taxi boat driver, say they just want to be able to still catch fish to feed their families and bring tourists to see dolphins here. For Saimoni, in Chapasak Province, Laos, I'm Colin Lovett, VOA News.
Be sure to check out the video for this story at our website, voanews.com. I'm Jim Stevenson. Daybreak Asia is a weekday feature of VOA. Longer versions of these stories are on our website. And don't miss a Daybreak Asia. Subscribe to our podcast. It's free. This is the time of day when we like to hear from you and tell you what you've told us. We welcome all of your feedback and your ideas. You can send them in a number of ways. Our Facebook page is VOA Asia. We always like you to stop by there and like us. We're on Twitter, Weiboa, and you can email your comments to us at voaasia@voanews.com, also via our website at voanews.com. One of the stories that we've posted, the United States says it's very concerned about a new report that predicts North Korea will expand its nuclear stockpile to as many as 100 weapons by the year 2020. Analysts say there are some disagreements over Pyongyang's nuclear capabilities, but no doubt the weapons program is posing a growing international threat. Mark wrote to us, 50 warheads? It only takes one warhead to kill, one warhead to devastate an area that will take decades to recover. Another comment from Anonymous. Please explain how an expert who has no connection to North Korea, which has an isolated state and information on its secret nuclear arsenal, appeal to authority fallacy? Typical American media, he writes. One of our other stories that we've posted online is a Pakistani cell phone user facing a deadline this week to match SIM cards with fingerprints. Analysts say that this move by the government could further a black market in illicit communications. Kepler8B from Canada writes, technically, this is a nation in a state of war. Security is the priority, not privacy. If NSA can secretly embed spyware in your home computer, why can't they openly ask their nationals to register their cell phone with a fingerprint? Well, certainly a lot of opinions on this story. You can read them all on our website. It's at voanews.com. We're getting a lot of great photos from you. With the recent Lunar New Year, we've asked you to send your pictures of the celebrations that you have been a part of or have seen, and keep sending them to us. We are collecting them on our VOA Asia Facebook page. You can also email them to us at voaasia@voanews.com. We're going to be going through all of these photos. We're going to pick one that we really, really like, and we're going to put it on our Facebook cover, so look for it soon.
I'm Ray Kugel with Cinem Asia, a movie look at Asian people, places, and things, both real and imagined. In China, taking wedding photographs is almost as important as the wedding ceremony and celebration. But that age-old tradition is now facing a significant change. The 80s generation, with its economic success, is finding another way. And a short branding film called Kitty and Lala shows quite a different picture, literally. Kitty and Lala are wedding photographers whose sense of style and imagination are taking the business to a new creative level. Based in Hangzhou, the pair, in their late 20s, uses location shooting and inventive backgrounds, often combined with colorful costumes, to provide vibrant pictures for a new young generation in China with money to spend. The photo blog for their company, called 80 Impression, is one of the most popular in China. Kitty and Lala is directed by 28-year-old Cho Lee. I spoke with Lee about the transformation surrounding wedding pictures in today's China and how Kitty and Lala put it all together.
Kitty and Lala went to university together, actually, and they just always had an interest in photography. Once they graduated, they were looking for some sort of project to do together, and they were looking at wedding photos that were being made in China at the time and thought that they could do better. So they just started this kind of really grassroots campaign of making wedding photos. I think they were doing stuff for free at first just to try to, you know, get a bit of practice and get their name and their brand out. And then pretty quickly, they became really popular.
Do Kitty and Lala split their duties?
When they first started, Kitty was doing all the makeup and the costumes, and Lala was the photographer. He was doing the technical side of things. So they now have a bunch of photographers and makeup artists, so their role is just more managing the business, guiding the creative side of it.
What caused the change in attitude and popularity for this kind of photography?
It's just something that speaks to younger generations. Previously, like, the standard of wedding photo was two people, husband and wife, standing in front of a plain background. I mean, it was very, very kind of stiff. And I think their style just speaks to this younger group, younger crowd of people who are now starting to realize that they have a voice. They have people out there with similar ideas. You know, there's a lot of young people in China that are kind of looking for something that's different from what their parents knew or experienced. So I think that they're riding on that wave of just change, really.
When did Kitty and Lala's success abroad begin, and how strong is the response from other Asian countries and beyond?
Kitty and Lala became quite successful very quickly, and over the last 2 to 3 years now, I think their business is still growing. I think certainly the style that they are doing, you know, you see a similar style in Korean wedding photos in other parts of Asia. Even in Australia, in Melbourne, we see the same kind of fun wedding photos taken.
Director Cho Lee uses a fast-paced style and exquisite use of split-screen cutting to make Kitty and Lala a dazzling film to watch. Individuality and the evolution in technology are what propels this successful new direction, taken by the two extremely talented wedding photographers. Lee's own artistic visual flair in telling their story shows he is very much a part of that creative talent pool as well. For more movie information, follow me at voanews.com. I'm Ray Kugel.
I'm Sarah Williams with China Focus. The number of Chinese tourists traveling overseas during the Chinese New Year hit a new peak this year, for the first time outnumbering those who travel domestically. Shannon Van Sant reports from Hong Kong, where authorities say the charged political climate last year contributed to a fall in visitors from the mainland.
According to Chinese state media, the number of mainland Chinese visitors to Hong Kong dropped for the first time since 2013. The drop in tourists from the mainland follows several months of pro-democracy protests that blocked Hong Kong streets. Protesters were demanding direct elections of the city's leader. Raymond Yang, a senior economist with ANZ, says the decline in tourism could pinch economic growth for a city that has long enjoyed a financial boom from mainland visitors.
Yeah, I think, of course, yes, the mainland tourist spending on Hong Kong represents probably one-third of the total retail sales in Hong Kong. So if they cut the spending, that will apparently affect the local retail segment.
China's state-run Global Times newspaper reported that more than 675,000 mainlanders visited Hong Kong during the first 5 days of the Chinese New Year holiday from Wednesday to Sunday. That is down 0.16% from last year. On Tuesday, Hong Kong's chief executive, Leung Chwing-ing, said the number of mainlanders who are permitted to travel as individual tourists to Hong Kong decreased by 5% compared to the same period last year. The number of mainland Chinese visitors traveling to other Asian destinations sharply increased. The number of visitors to Macau saw a 6.7% annual increase, while news portal ChinaNews.com reported the number of Chinese mainland tourists visiting Japan in January increased by 45% to about 226,000 compared to the previous year. Chinese media have attributed the decline in mainland tourists to Hong Kong's pro-democracy demonstrations. During last year's protests, China state media largely ignored Hong Kong residents' political grievances, instead reporting that the demonstrations mainly were driven by xenophobia and prejudice towards mainland Chinese. Many protesters at the time mainly aired their grievances against China's central government in Beijing, which controls Hong Kong policy, saying they had no issue with mainland Chinese. But in more recent months, after the government effectively shut down the protest, some groups of demonstrators have started targeting mainland Chinese visitors at Hong Kong shopping malls, chanting, "Go home, locust." Demonstrators said their protests are fueled in part by parallel traders, or mainland Chinese, who travel to Hong Kong to buy items in bulk to then sell at a cheaper rate on the mainland. Yang says ultimately the demonstrations could weaken Hong Kong's reputation as a shopping and travel destination for mainlanders.
Symbolically, it wouldn't be positive, you know, if this type of message or paying a wrong message to the mainland that Hong Kong no longer welcome Chinese tourists, that might be some negative impact. Could be some demotivation for them to come to Hong Kong as the first choice.
In response to the complaints about the large numbers of mainland shoppers, Hong Kong's chief executive, CY Leung, recently said he will consider restricting the number of Chinese tourists allowed to enter Hong Kong. China National Tourism Association's website reports that during the Chinese New Year holiday, more than 5 million Chinese traveled overseas to areas other than Hong Kong and Macau. Shannon Van Sant for VOA News, Hong Kong.
An editor at the American Internet news media company BuzzFeed lost his iPhone at a bar in New York City a year ago. But now he plans to travel to China next month to meet a Chinese man who has the iPhone. 27-year-old Matt Stopra plans to visit Meizhou in Guangdong province. He will meet Mr. Li, who is also known as Brother Orange because of photos of him in front of an orange tree. The two men have connected through Sina Weibo, and while they speak different languages, their posts have been translated by others. Stopra was able to find his lost iPhone online through pictures Li has posted. The BuzzFeed editor told the New York Times that he's looking forward to his visit to China and hopes to celebrate the Lantern Festival. And perhaps Stoffera will finally find out how his iPhone traveled from a New York bar to southern China. Follow us on Weibo. That's China Focus. I'm Sarah Williams.
From the Voice of America, this is Asia Business News. I'm Jim Stevenson. Chinese investors seeking green cards to live in the United States run the risk of being defrauded under a loosely regulated visa program, according to a report released Thursday from a federal watchdog. The U.S.-China Economic and Security Review Commission raises questions about America's EB-5 visa program, which grants green cards to foreigners in return for investments of $1 million, or just $500,000, in high unemployment or rural areas. Local government officials are supposed to vet investors and their projects before visa applications are approved. The commission cites the case of a real estate developer indicted last year on charges of duping 290 Chinese investors into sinking money into a fraudulent $912 million hotel complex outside of Chicago. And in South Dakota, a state official committed suicide in 2013 after coming under investigation for mismanaging Chinese and South Korean EB-5 investment funds connected to a failed beef packing plant. China has imposed a one-year ban on ivory imports that took immediate effect Thursday amid criticism that its citizens have a huge appetite for ivory and has fueled poaching that threatens the existence of African elephants. The State Administration of Forestry declared the ban in a public notice posted on its official site. It says the administration would not handle any import request. North Korea has told its rival South Korea it plans to unilaterally raise the minimum wage for North Korean employed by southern companies at a jointly run industrial park. That's beginning in May, according to officials who said that on Thursday. Let's look at Asia Business News on the Voice of America.
This is Today in History. On February 27, 1900, the British Labour Party was founded. It is today the largest centre-left political party in the United Kingdom. In 1922, then-Commerce Secretary Herbert Hoover convened the first national radio conference. The conference called for the federal control of broadcasting in the U.S. In 1933, Germany's parliament building, the Reichstag, was burned. The Nazis blamed the communists and used the fire as a pretext for suspending civil liberties and increasing their power. On this day in 1934, the automobile safety advocate and political activist Ralph Nader was born in Winsted, Connecticut. On this day in 1972, U.S. President Richard Nixon, at the conclusion of an historic visit to China, joined Chinese Premier Zhou Enlai in signing the so-called Shanghai Communique. The document opened the way for normalized relations, achieved 7 years later. In 1973, 200 Sioux Indians, led by members of AIM, the American Indian Movement, occupied the town of Wounded Knee, South Dakota, the site of an 1890 massacre by the U.S. Army. The occupation lasted for just over 70 days, during which time two Indians were shot to death by federal agents and several more were wounded. On February 27, 1991, President George H.W. Bush declared coalition forces had liberated Kuwait after 7 months of occupation by the Iraqi army. And on this day in 1995, Court-appointed salvagers swarmed into Barings Bank, Britain's oldest investment bank, to evaluate its remaining assets in the aftermath of a collapse. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
You're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. Coming up, could the masked Islamic State terrorist who beheaded several hostages finally have been identified? Well, we'll have an exclusive report from the front lines of the battle between Syrian Christian fighters and Islamic State militants in northeastern Syria. And we'll tell you why Washington is paying such close attention to Nigeria's upcoming election. I'm Michael Lippin. Media reports say the masked Islamic State militant who appeared in several recent videos of hostage beheadings has been tentatively identified. The reports quote friends of Kuwaiti-born London resident Mohammed Mwazi as saying they believe that he is the tall, British-accented speaker dubbed Jihadi John. Two U.S. government sources told the Reuters news agency that that investigators believe Mwazi is the masked man. But VOA's Jamie Detmer in Rome says European intelligence sources have refused to confirm that identification, saying the issue is more complicated. A U.S. National Security Council spokeswoman would not confirm or deny the reports about the identity of Jihadi John. Assyrian and Kurdish militias battling Islamic State militants in northeastern Syria are asking the international community to provide them with weapons capable of changing the balance of power in the region. A leader with the Syriac Military Council told VOA that the Assyrian militia is holding its ground against the Islamic State with the help of Kurdish fighters. The militia leader said his group does not need more fighters, but increased weapons and air support that only foreign powers could provide. Well, Islamic State militants have captured several Assyrian Christian villages in Syria's Hasakah province in recent days. The militants also have taken hundreds of Christian hostages in an apparent act of ethnic cleansing. VOA Kurdish service reporter Zana Omer went to the frontline village of Tel Makes, still in Assyrian Christian hands, and has this report narrated by Rob Rafael.
Get down. Here, all this is open area. They control these villages. At night, we are scared they'll infiltrate us from this area. In daytime, they have snipers. That village was a base of two snipers. The river separates us, and the same thing for the other villages. Just the river is between us.
Over there is Tal Nasri, and then Tal Shamiran and Tal Tamir. All these villages are controlled by IS. They have hidden cells which appear at night.
This area is called Tel Mahas. The Kabor River is the border, with the Assyrian Christian and Kurdish YPG fighters on this side and Islamic State on the other, where IS fighters have kidnapped the civilians. These Assyrian fighters are guarding now. The fate of the hundreds of Assyrian Christian hostages held by Islamic State remains unclear. And after days of local fighters asking for international help, coalition military aircraft could finally be heard over the area Thursday. For Zana Omer in Tel Mahas, Syria, Robert Rafael, VOA News.
Russia is warning Western countries not to impose more sanctions against it, saying that such threats show that the West is opposed to following through on a truce for eastern Ukraine. Both the United States and some leaders in Europe have threatened to impose tougher sanctions on Moscow if it does not stop supporting pro-Russian separatists in the Ukrainian conflict. On Thursday, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov called those threats an attempt to deflect attention from the need to follow through on the terms of a ceasefire, which has only recently begun to take hold. Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan has paid a surprise visit to the country's northeast, the epicenter of a Boko Haram Islamist insurgency. On Thursday, the president met with Nigerian troops in Baga and Mubi, two towns the army recently recaptured from the insurgents. Mr. Jonathan's office said he also did an aerial inspection of other recaptured areas and stopped in the Borno state capital, Maiduguri, to meet with the state governor. While violence in northeastern Nigeria continued on Thursday, witnesses said a suicide bomber killed at least 19 people in the Borno state town of Biu, the site of previous attacks claimed by Boko Haram. Separately, the French news agency said twin bombings near a bus station and university in the central Nigerian city of Jos killed 17 people. A top U.S. State Department official says Nigeria's upcoming national election is a bellwether for the African continent, in which a dozen nations are planning elections in the next 2 years. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
Nigeria is Africa's most populous nation, its biggest economy, and the continent's top oil producer. And so it follows that everyone, including top U.S. officials, are watching as Nigeria plans to hold a key national election. The vote was set for this month, but was moved back when the military said it would not be able to provide sufficient security amid fighting the extremist Boko Haram group, which has waged a war of terror in the nation's north. U.S. Assistant Secretary of State Linda Thomas-Greenfield told reporters this week she has been personally assured by top Nigerian officials that the vote will be held in late March.
We're all watching this election. This election will be a bellwether for the entire continent. The world is watching. The continent is watching. Nigeria's neighbors are watching this election. And our hope is that the election will be free and fair, that it will be transparent, it will be peaceful, and that the results of the election will reflect the will of the people of Nigeria.
She noted the United States is working with every single one of the dozen or so African nations planning to hold elections this year and in 2016, including Burundi and Ethiopia. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
U.S. regulators have banned internet service providers from charging content providers high fees for faster streaming of web material. Well, following the vote on so-called net neutrality rules, the Federal Communications Commission Chairman Tom Wheeler said the American people reasonably expect and deserve an internet that is fast, fair, and open. Today, he said, they got what they deserve. And also in the U.S., a law that legalizes marijuana use is now in effect for Washington, D.C. The new law, which voters passed in a referendum last November, took effect shortly after midnight Thursday. The law allows adults 21 and over to privately possess up to 56 grams of marijuana and to grow small amounts of marijuana indoors. But buying, selling, and smoking marijuana in public is still against the law. The U.S. capital city joins the states of Alaska, Colorado, and Washington in legalizing recreational marijuana use. Well, that's it for International Edition on the Voice of America. We'll be back at 0330 Universal Time for an expanded look at the latest world news. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington.
I'm Jim Stevenson with Business News on the Voice of America. IBM CEO says the company's plan to revamp its business to shift away from hardware and focus on business analytics, cloud computing, mobile service, and security is on track. In a media briefing ahead of an investor conference in New York Thursday, Virginia Romity said the company plans that the new tech market should make up 40% of IBM's business, or about $40 billion in the next 4 years. That's up from 13% 5 years ago, 27% by the end of this year. Once the dominant PC maker known as Big Blue, IBM is confronting a sales slump as it struggles to adapt to big changes in the way businesses buy software and other commercial technology. It issued another disappointing earnings report in January as both revenue and profit fell in the December quarter. A plunge in gas prices last month lowered consumer prices by the most in 6 years, but excluding the volatile food and energy costs, prices rose. The consumer price index fell 0.7% in January. That's the sharpest drop since December 2008, according to Labor Department statistics released Thursday. Tumbling prices at the pump drove nearly all of the decline. Core prices, which exclude food and energy, rose 0.2%. Despite the sharp drop in the overall index, economists see signs that many prices are moving higher. The cost of services such as hotels, restaurant, food, and rents all rose last month, lifting core prices.
More Americans sought unemployment aid last week, although the number of applications was still consistent with steady hiring. The Labor Department says the weekly applications rose 31,000 to a seasonally adjusted 313,000. That's the most in 6 weeks. Applications are a proxy for potential layoffs. That's a look at business news on VOA Global. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're glad to have you with us on VOA Global today. By the way, we are asking you to send your photos from the Lunar New Year celebrations, whatever they may be. If it was just a small celebration you were involved in or something really large, something spectacular, send them to us. We're going to be looking through all the photos, and we're going to put the one that we like the most on our Facebook homepage. So we look forward to posting that. Right now, we've got Ira Melman and the American Cafe.
I'm Ira Melman in the American Cafe. This has been a very cold winter for much of the United States. In its biggest city, New York, many of its millions of residents can't afford to stay warm. VOA's Ramon Taylor has the story here in the cafe.
For the more than 8 million people who called New York City home, the key to surviving the cold is simple. Bundle up and stay indoors whenever possible. But for the less fortunate, it's more complicated. Many can't even afford a winter coat.
In New York City today, there are over 2 million people who are having a terrible time finding food on the table, to clothe their children, and to exist in a normal, everyday way. So clothes are a very important part of that.
Tim Gibson is a volunteer at New York Cares, the largest volunteer management organization in New York City. Each year, beginning in October, they team up with local businesses and nonprofits to collect and distribute used coats to those in need. The demand this year, 103,000. One quarter of the requests are for children. The initiative extends to 300 drop-off locations throughout the city and beyond. Online users can donate a brand new jacket through Amazon.com. With temperatures regularly dropping below freezing and time running out, New York Cares has collected and donated approximately 71,000 coats so far this winter. As Derek Matai explains, the locals still in need are not always the most obvious candidates.
What a lot of people don't realize, or some people do realize, is the city is super expensive. And a lot of the coats that are going out to help other people, they are not only going out to people who may be on the streets without a home, but they're hardworking New Yorkers that just can't afford that next meal or to provide warmth for their families.
For some, the gift of warmth is personal and sometimes taken for granted.
When you wear a coat, you feel happy, you feel more relaxed, you know, you feel warm.
Ramon Taylor, VOA News, New York.
From the cold of New York to the warmth and sunshine of Hawaii, Michael Sullivan drew the enviable assignment of visiting the 50th U.S. state for a report into research into sharks. Scientists are getting a shark's eye view now of their environment to better understand the threats that face this important predator.
The University of Hawaii research site on Coconut Island is just minutes by motorboat from the shore of Oahu, the most populated island in the Hawaiian chain. The facility is a good place to observe sharks since they are native to local waters, and some are kept in this sheltered bay for study. Carl Meyer does research on sharks and tries to learn about their habits.
When sharks are feeding and hopefully how much they're eating, and that's what we use these captive animals for.
Scientists also monitor the behavior of sharks at sea, placing sensing pellets in their food to monitor digestion, measuring the animals, and then releasing them with radio-equipped electronic tags attached to their fins. The researchers recently fitted a sandbar shark with a camera for a rare shark's eye view of its daily activities.
When we recovered the camera, we saw that the shark had spent the day in a large aggregation of sharks. Not just sandbar sharks, but also black-tip sharks and many, many scalloped hammerhead sharks.
Sharks are swift and lethal, but don't usually prey on humans. Meyer says that rare attacks are amplified by the media and dramatized in films. He says sharks are important top-level predators that help maintain the balance of the marine systems. University of Hawaii scientists are studying endangered and vulnerable shark populations, and Carl Meyer says that humans are more of a risk to sharks than sharks to humans. And he says the results of those environmental changes cannot always be predicted. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News, Coconut Island, Hawaii.
I'm Ira Melman in the American Cafe. Join us on air and online at voanews.com.
Hi, everyone. This is David Byrd, and here's what's happening now. Do you own a pet? Would you like some help training them or keeping track of them? Well, there's some new devices that might be just what you need. If you own a dog and you want to train it to fetch and then wait quietly, the auto trainer might be just the trick. It fires a ball and then dispenses food when your dog returns the ball to the machine. Kirsten Dillon told Britain's Sky News the auto trainer helps her with her French bulldog, Louis.
So what it's doing is, if you listen, it's telling Louis that food is coming by reaching a certain pitch. So he knows, he's learning that if he waits patiently and quietly, more to the point, food is going to be delivered.
The auto trainer is just one of several devices that can help teach Rover what to do. With life becoming more hectic in our modern world, Kirsten Dillon says so-called pet tech is just what people need.
We're busier and busier, and we're looking for more and more ways to help us out. Of course, there's a huge market for assistance dogs, and it's growing and it's growing. And there are lots of people with physical disabilities that actually need this technology. So it isn't just a case of lazy owners. There are people out there that do need help.
A U.S.-based company, Fitbark, makes an activity monitor to make sure your dog gets enough exercise. It costs about $70. The Petsy Connect by Petzilla even lets owners watch their pets and interact with them from anywhere using a smartphone. That sells for about $170. And if you want to make sure that Rover is healthy, there's even a pet urine testing kit available from Petnostics. That allows owners to analyze their pet's urine and see the results on their smartphone. But is all this tech good for that human-animal bond we all enjoy? Well, Jordan Shelley of Dogs Today magazine told Sky News that the tech helps, but the face-to-snout time is still needed.
But as long as there's some kind of a balance, you know, and they're used as training aids, then it's not a problem. You know, when you take vitamin C tablets, you also continue eating your fruits, yeah? It's the same sort of thing.
The American Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals says that in 2012, 62% of American households owned at least one pet. Americans spent more than $54 billion on their pets last year, and that number is expected to go up. From tracking your pets to tracking firearms now, a Silicon Valley startup has come up with a device that will help police departments know when an officer's gun has been fired. The device from Yardarm Technologies lets dispatchers know when an officer's gun goes off. It also tracks the weapon and tells what direction it was fired in. This device uses geolocation to show where officers are, and it can tell the dispatcher if an officer draws a gun. Jim Schaff is Yardarm's marketing vice president.
So we're connecting the firearm to the internet, and from there we can do a lot of things with it.
Schaff told the Associated Press that the device doesn't interfere with officers' performance in any way.
The officer simply inserts it into the back of the firearm, and now it's installed. They don't even know it's there anymore.
The Santa Cruz County Sheriff's Department in California is currently testing the system. Sheriff Phil Wovak says that it will allow his department to see when officers need help.
We're going to be able to see in real time if our officers are in trouble and they're unable to ask for assistance. That's the worst nightmare for any police officer in the field.
The yardarm device relies on the Internet and connects to officers' smartphones using Bluetooth. It can also feed information to crime scene investigators to let them know how a gun was used. So, what do you think? Let us know your thoughts on these stories or anything else you hear on our program by logging on to our Facebook page, VOA Asia, and you can email us at voaasia@voanews.com. That's what's happening now. Until next time, I'm David Byrd.
VOA Global is our collection of various podcasts that we produce every day here at the Voice of America, and a lot of different ways that you can reach us at VOA Global. You can go to our Facebook page, VOA Asia. And, of course, when you stop by there, please like us. We're also on SoundCloud and on Twitter. You can follow my Twitter feed at VOA Stevenson. And I'll keep you up to date on all the latest news and developments around the clock every day. Time for sports on the Voice of America. I'm Jim Stevenson. A strong wind welcomed the PGA Tour to Florida on Thursday, and Jim Herman didn't mind one bit. He saved par from the fairway twice, kept bogeys off of his card for a 5-under par 65, and took the early lead at the Honda Classic at PGA National. He was one shot ahead of Brendan Steele. Rory McIlroy got off to a rugged start in the afternoon. The world's top player already was 4-over par through 6 holes. For starters, Herman was happy just to be playing. This was the second straight week that he was in a Monday qualifier when he got word that he was in the tournament. And he has lived in South Florida for more than a decade, so he's a little bit used to the wind. Phil Mickelson was there. He opened with a 71. Day one of the Joburg Open has concluded, with South Africa's Nick Henning leading the way after a fine round of 62. It's a pretty big event with 201 players spread out over 2 courses. Mark Tompkins has more.
Well, there's very much a South African feel to the top of the leaderboard after day one of the Joburg Open. Nick Henning, a fine round of 62, sees him at the top, 9-under par after a great round on the West course. And Eagle 3 saw him at 4-under par through his opening 3 holes. And that really set the tone for the rest of his round.
I knew I was swinging nicely, but, you know, I haven't made a score like that for many, many years. So it's a really nice surprise.
He's one shot clear of another South African, Titch Moore, who got a hole in one on the par 3-5th, and the Belgian Thomas Peters, who's also at 8-under par, and they were joined later on in the afternoon by Tjaart van der Vaart, who also shot a round of 63 on the West course. The West course providing the best scores today. The best score on the East course, Wally Coetzee down in a tie for 8th place with a 66. And a mention for the Englishman Sam Hutsby, who's yet to make the cut this year. He finished with a 66, 6-under par, to leave him 3 shots up the lead, held overnight by Nick Henning, who will play on the East course tomorrow.
Mark Tompkins from Johannesburg. A federal judge has cleared the way for Minnesota Vikings running back Adrian Peterson to be reinstated, ruling that a National Football League arbitrator failed to meet his duty in a child abuse case that shook the league. U.S. District Judge David Doty issued the order Thursday, less than 3 weeks after hearing oral arguments. Doty overruled NFL arbitrator Harold Henderson's denial of Peterson's appeal. The league had suspended Peterson through at least April 15th under its personal conduct policy. That's sports on VOA.
Hi, I'm Ray McDonald on The Voice of America, and this is a Top 5 Countdown. We're partying with the 5 most popular songs in the Billboard Hot 100 Pop Singles Chart for the week ending February 28th, 2015. Now, I want you all to be on your best behavior, because we greet a true musical legend this week. He's just minutes away, but first, let's roll Maroon 5 in 5th place with Sugar. These guys were on hand at Sunday's Oscar telecast. Hold on for more. Sugar! Maroon 5 steps back a slot to fifth place with Sugar. On Sunday, the band was in Los Angeles performing at the Academy Awards ceremony. Adam Levine and company sang Lost Stars from the movie Begin Again. It was nominated for Best Original Song but lost to Glory by John Legend and Common. Now, as for that musical legend I mentioned, Paul McCartney turns up in our fourth place song, 4 or 5 Seconds, along with Rihanna and Kanye West. Paul's been away from the top five for a very long time. Stay with me for details.
Now I'm 4 or 5 seconds from wildin', and we got 3 more days till Friday. I'm just trying to make it back home by Monday morning. I swear I wish somebody would tell me, ooh, that's all I want.
Rihanna, Kanye West, and Paul McCartney jumped 2 slots to fourth place with 4 or 5 Seconds. It's the lead single from Rihanna's upcoming 8th album, which features Kanye as executive producer. We don't have a release date yet, but it should be soon. As for Paul, he hasn't cracked the U.S. top five since 1983, when he and Michael Jackson topped the Hot 100 with Say, Say, Say. Well, it's all a bit of an anti-climax from here, I'm afraid. Good old Hozier remains in third place with Take Me to Church.
Take me to church, I worship like a dog at the shrine of your life. I'll tell you my sins and you can sharpen your knife. Offer me that deathless death, the good God, let me give you my life. Take me to church, I worship like a dog at the shrine of your life. I'll tell you my sins and you can sharpen your knife. Offer me that deathless death, the good God, let me give you my life.
Hozier remains stuck in third place with Take Me to Church. It has hit number one in 12 countries, including Austria, Canada, the Czech Republic, Hungary, Lebanon, Poland, and Switzerland. Ed Sheeran spends another week in second place with Thinking Out Loud. Ed's calendar is full, and I'll break it down after the song.
So honey, now, take me into your loving arms. Kiss me under the light of a thousand stars. Place your head on my beating heart. I'm thinking now.
Ed Sheeran treads water in second place with Thinking Out Loud. On Wednesday, he's at the Brit Awards, where he may pick up 3 trophies. After that, Ed flies to the Middle East and India before touring Asia, Australia, and New Zealand. 1 week's rest, and then he hits South America. Up at number one, it's 7 weeks and counting for Mark Ronson and Bruno Mars with Uptown Funk. This single is topping charts the world over, but there's one place you'll never hear Mark sing. Keep it here for more.
Girl sent you hallelujah. Girl sent you hallelujah. Girl sent you hallelujah. Cause Uptown Funk don't give it to you. Cause Uptown Funk don't give it to you. Cause Uptown Funk don't give it to you. Saturday night and we in the spot. Don't believe me, just watch.
Mark Ronson and Bruno Mars rule the Hot 100 for a lucky 7th week with Uptown Funk. Mark tells the New York Post that while the song's a hit, he knows his own voice is terrible, and he won't even sing in the shower. Well, our shower of hits is over, but it all starts again next week. Thank you so much for dropping by. I'm Ray McDonald, and this has been the Top 5 Countdown on The Voice of America.
It's been rather a tough time for residents of a Dutch town. They've been cowering under umbrellas after an aggressive eagle owl began swooping out of the sky, sinking its talons into them and gouging their flesh. The so-called terror owl has become somewhat of a media sensation after attacking people in recent weeks in and around Purmerend. It's about 20 kilometers north of Amsterdam. The hardest hit area in the town is an assisted living complex for people with disabilities. A spokeswoman for the complex, Lieselette de Bruin, said that the owl has attacked up to 20 people in recent weeks, sometimes causing injuries that required stitches. One resident who happened to fall prey to this owl told local media it was quite a painful experience. He said it was like having a brick laced with nails thrown at your head. I don't know how he knows that a brick laced with nails feels like that, but that's what he said. The town is warning residents to steer clear of the bird if possible. It's reported to be quite large, 60 to 75 centimeters tall. And the town has applied for a permit to catch the owl, which is a protected species. Seems like the residents need protection. Officials suspect the terror owl was once kept in captivity. They say such aggressive behavior is not known among wild eagle owls, and the species is not actually commonly found in the region. In the meantime, the town has advised its residents not to approach the bird and use umbrellas, if possible, while they're walking around in the evening. Our umbrellas are up as we're ready to leave Studio 22 at our VOA headquarters. We thank you for joining us today. Our director is Tracy Carter. Daryl Smith is our engineer. And our managing editor is Diane Gao. I'm Jim Stevenson. We hope to join with you again tomorrow for another edition of VOA Global.